A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the strike today on Beirut, targeting what Israel described as a precision military warehouse. The question isn't about the strike itself, but about the logistics behind it. Why do groups like Hezbollah sometimes store weapons in above-ground warehouses when they've also built extensive underground tunnel networks? What drives that choice? And how sophisticated are their supply chains compared to a standing military? Plus, given that Israeli intelligence is watching all of it, how does the obfuscation game actually work?
There's a lot to pull apart here, and honestly, most coverage of these strikes never gets past the headline. The warehouse question is fascinating because it's not just tactical. It reveals how these groups think about cost, risk, and time horizons in ways that are genuinely different from a state military.
Because the instinctive reaction is always, why wouldn't you put everything underground? You've already dug the tunnels.
That instinct is wrong in at least three different directions. Let me start with something concrete. In November of 2024, the IDF released footage of a strike on what they called a Hezbollah precision missile production facility near Saida Zainab, south of Damascus. That facility was above ground, in an industrial zone, surrounded by civilian factories. It was producing Fateh 110 and M600 missiles. These are guided munitions with ranges of up to 300 kilometers. And the facility wasn't hidden in a cave. It was in what looked from the outside like a standard manufacturing plant.
This isn't a hypothetical. They're running full production lines above ground.
Full production lines. And the reason is straightforward. Precision manufacturing requires controlled environments. Temperature, humidity, ventilation, access to heavy machinery, power grids. You can't mill guidance system components in a tunnel without building what is essentially an underground factory, which costs orders of magnitude more and takes years longer. The Iranians learned this the hard way with their underground enrichment facilities. They still needed above-ground support infrastructure.
The tunnel network is for what, exactly?
The tunnels are primarily for three things: command and control, short-range rocket storage and launch, and personnel movement. Hezbollah's tunnel network in southern Lebanon, and we've seen detailed mapping of this since 2006, is optimized for tactical mobility. Small teams moving through, popping up, firing, disappearing. The rockets stored in those tunnels tend to be shorter range, less sophisticated systems. Grad rockets, things you can manhandle through a corridor.
Like the difference between keeping your camping gear in the basement versus trying to run a machine shop down there.
And here's where the logistics thinking gets interesting. Hezbollah's supply chain has evolved dramatically since 2012, when they first started getting significant Iranian support for indigenous production. Before that, they were almost entirely dependent on smuggling finished weapons from Iran through Syria. That meant everything had to be small enough to transport covertly, disassembled, hidden in commercial shipments, moved through the Damascus airport or overland through Iraq. Now they have what amounts to a distributed manufacturing network. The Iranians shifted strategy around 2014-2015. Instead of shipping finished missiles, they started shipping components, machine tools, and technical expertise. Build it locally, closer to the point of use. It's the same logic that drives any multinational manufacturer to build regional factories. Shorter supply lines, harder to interdict, and you can scale production to local demand.
Which also means your above-ground footprint grows, because now you need actual factory space.
And that brings us to the warehouse question. Warehouses serve a different function than tunnel storage. A warehouse near Beirut, especially in the Dahiya district, which is Hezbollah's traditional stronghold, is a logistics node. It's where components arrive, get sorted, get quality checked, and get distributed to production sites or forward storage. You can't do that efficiently underground. Loading docks, forklifts, inventory management, these are real constraints.
The warehouse the IDF struck today was likely a transshipment point, not a final storage site.
And that matters because it tells you about the tempo of their operations. If you're moving components through a warehouse, you're operating on a just-in-time or near just-in-time model. Components arrive, sit for days or weeks at most, then move out. The warehouse is a pulse point in the supply chain, not a stockpile.
Which makes the targeting window very narrow.
And that's where the Israeli intelligence challenge gets acute. You're not looking for a static cache that's been there for 6 months. You're looking for a shipment that arrived on a Tuesday and will be gone by Friday. The lead time on actionable intelligence is maybe 48 to 72 hours.
Let me ask the obvious question. If they know the IDF is watching, and they know warehouses are vulnerable, why not accept the inefficiency and put everything underground anyway?
Because the inefficiency isn't marginal, it's crippling. Let me give you numbers. Moving a standard 20-foot container of components through an underground facility requires either a vertical shaft with a heavy lift, which is a massive engineering project and a massive signature for surveillance, or a horizontal entrance large enough for trucks, which is also a massive signature. Either way, you've created a choke point that's easier to monitor and easier to strike. A warehouse in an urban area surrounded by civilian traffic is harder to distinguish from every other warehouse in the neighborhood.
The concealment strategy is actually about blending into the urban fabric, not hiding from it.
And Hezbollah has been doing this for decades. The Dahiya district alone, we're talking about a dense urban area of maybe 15 square kilometers, population over 500,000. Thousands of commercial buildings, hundreds of warehouses. Most of them are exactly what they appear to be, a small fraction or not. Distinguishing which is which requires human intelligence, signals intelligence, pattern of life analysis over weeks or months.
The civilian embedding is the point, not a side effect.
It's the entire defensive strategy. Hezbollah's doctrine and Hamas's in Gaza treats the civilian population as a shield, not just rhetorically, but operationally. The 2006 war taught Hezbollah that Israel is highly sensitive to civilian casualties and international pressure. So the logical response from their perspective is to make every military asset as difficult to strike without civilian harm as possible. Warehouses in residential neighborhoods, rocket launchers in apartment courtyards, command centers under hospitals.
Which is also why the human shield accusation isn't just a talking point. It's a describable operational doctrine with documented infrastructure.
It's been documented extensively. The IDF has published detailed maps of Hezbollah's Dahiya infrastructure, weapons storage under apartment buildings, rocket launch sites adjacent to schools, the whole pattern. Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have documented the same thing, though they frame it differently. The operational reality isn't seriously disputed.
Let's talk about the supply chain itself. You mentioned components coming from Iran. What does that route actually look like?
It's a multimodal network that's evolved significantly. The primary route since about 2018 has been overland from Iran through Iraq into Syria, then into Lebanon. Some components go by air into Damascus. There's been a steady pattern of Iranian cargo flights, nominally civilian, landing at Damascus International with cargo that doesn't match the manifests. Some go by sea to Latakia or Tartus, then overland. And there's a secondary route through Turkey for certain dual-use components that are easier to source commercially.
Dual-use? Meaning things that could be bought for civilian manufacturing, but end up in guidance systems?
Precision accelerometers, gyroscopes, certain alloys, specialized circuit boards. Iran has gotten very good at building global procurement networks that source these components from manufacturers in Europe, East Asia, even the United States, often through shell companies in third countries. There was a Reuters investigation in 2024 that traced Iranian procurement networks operating through front companies in the UAE, Turkey, and Malaysia.
The supply chain isn't a single pipeline. It's a distributed procurement web with multiple nodes and redundancies.
That's what makes it resilient. If one route gets interdicted, others compensate. If one supplier gets shut down, they find another. The Iranians have been operating under sanctions for over 4 decades. They built an entire institutional expertise around sanctions, evasion, and covert logistics.
How does Hezbollah's logistics compare to, say, a NATO standard military?
It's a different animal entirely. A NATO logistics corps is optimized for volume, speed, and standardization. They move division-sized units with thousands of vehicles. They have dedicated logistics battalions. They operate on established doctrine with predictable supply classes and consumption rates. Hezbollah's logistics are optimized for survivability and deniability. They can't move division-sized anything because that would be instantly detected and struck. so instead they move small quantities through many channels, stockpile in dispersed locations, and accept lower throughput in exchange for lower detectability.
It's the difference between a freight rail network and a system of bicycle couriers.
The bicycle couriers are individually harder to spot, harder to interdict, and if you lose one, you've lost a tiny fraction of your throughput. But the coordination overhead is enormous.
That coordination. That's where signals intelligence comes in, right? The more you have to coordinate dispersed movements, the more communications you generate.
That's been one of the most significant shifts in this conflict. Hezbollah learned after 2006 that cell phones and satellite phones were death warrants. They shifted heavily to couriers and fixed-line fiber-optic networks. They built their own internal communications grid in Lebanon, separate from the national infrastructure. But that grid still generates signals, still has nodes that can be mapped, still requires maintenance that creates observable patterns.
The obfuscation game is a constant trade-off between speed and silence.
That trade-off is where most of the operational decisions get made. Do you move a shipment tonight when cloud cover reduces satellite visibility but road traffic is lighter and more noticeable? Or do you move it during the day, blended into commercial traffic, but under full satellite coverage? These are the calculations that logistics officers are making constantly.
Let me pull on a thread you mentioned earlier. The shift from smuggling finished weapons to indigenous production. What does that do to the supply chain's vulnerability?
It transforms it. When you're smuggling finished missiles, the loss of a single shipment is catastrophic. You've lost the entire weapon system. When you're smuggling components, the loss of a shipment is a delay, not a defeat. You can source alternative components, you can adjust production schedules, you can draw from stockpiles. It's the difference between losing a finished car in transit versus losing a shipment of alternators. Annoying, but you can find another alternator.
The move to local production is itself an obfuscation strategy. It reduces the value of any single interdiction point.
And it makes the intelligence problem harder, because now you're not just looking for missiles. You're looking for the precursors to missiles, which look a lot like ordinary industrial goods. A guidance system in pieces looks like electronics components. A rocket motor casing looks like a specialized pipe. The signature is much fuzzier.
The production facilities themselves. You mentioned the one near Damascus. Are these purpose-built military factories, or are they dual-use facilities?
Almost always dual-use, or at least dual-use in appearance. The Sayyida Zainab facility was in an industrial zone surrounded by legitimate manufacturing. The buildings didn't look like military installations. No perimeter security visible from the outside. No obvious military vehicles. No uniformed personnel at the entrances. They looked like every other factory in the zone. That's the point.
Which means the intelligence process for identifying them isn't spot the military base. It's spot the one factory in 200 that's doing something slightly different.
Slightly different might mean things like, the truck traffic pattern is unusual for the stated business. A textile factory shouldn't be receiving shipments of aluminum tubes. A food processing plant shouldn't have chemical precursors showing up in trace atmospheric sampling. These are subtle signals that require persistent surveillance and deep domain knowledge to interpret.
How good is Hezbollah's operational security around these facilities?
They've gotten much better since 2006, but they still make mistakes. The most common failure mode is communications discipline. Someone uses a cell phone when they shouldn't. Someone sends an unencrypted message. Someone's pattern of life changes in a detectable way. Human factors are always the weakest link in any security system.
That's where the IDF's human intelligence network comes in.
Which is extensive and has been operating in Lebanon for decades. But it's also a cat and mouse game. Hezbollah runs counterintelligence operations. They root out informants. They compartmentalize information so that any single compromised individual only knows a small piece of the puzzle. The result is that Israeli intelligence often knows that something is happening in a general area without knowing exactly which building, exactly when.
Which brings us back to the warehouse strike today. If the intelligence is often imprecise at the granular level, how does a precision strike happen?
A combination of factors converging. Signals intelligence might pick up communications about a shipment. Human intelligence might confirm the general location. Imagery intelligence might show unusual vehicle activity over several days. Pattern of life analysis might identify a building that doesn't behave like its neighbors. When enough of these threads converge, you get a high confidence target.
The confidence level is never 100%.
There's always residual uncertainty. The decision to strike is always a judgment call weighing the value of the target against the risk of error and the risk of civilian harm. And that judgment is made under time pressure because the window closes fast.
Let's talk about the tunnel side of this more concretely. What have we actually seen in terms of Hezbollah's underground infrastructure?
The most detailed public accounting came after the IDF's ground operations in southern Lebanon in late 2024. They uncovered a network that was far more extensive than what was known in 2006. We're talking about tunnels with reinforced concrete walls, electrical infrastructure, ventilation systems, medical facilities, armories, command rooms with communications gear. Some of these tunnels were large enough to drive vehicles through.
These aren't crawl spaces, they're subterranean bases.
Full subterranean bases. And they're connected in a network that allows movement across significant distances without surface exposure. The IDF estimated the total tunnel length in southern Lebanon at hundreds of kilometers. And that's just what they found.
Building that kind of infrastructure, what's the timeline? How long does it take?
Years to decades. The tunneling effort likely began in earnest after 2006 and accelerated significantly after 2012. North Korea was reportedly involved in providing tunneling expertise and equipment, drawing on their own extensive experience with underground military infrastructure. The Iranians funded it. The scale of investment is enormous. We're talking billions of dollars over 15 plus years.
Which makes the above-ground warehouse question even sharper. If they've invested billions in underground infrastructure, why leave anything above ground at all?
Because the tunnels, extensive as they are, serve a specific function that doesn't overlap perfectly with logistics hubs. Think of the tunnel network as the tactical layer. It's for moving fighters, storing ready-to-use munitions, and providing command posts that can survive airstrikes. The logistics layer, manufacturing, component storage, quality control, heavy maintenance, requires space, power, and accessibility that tunnels can't easily provide.
The tunnels are the retail operation, and the warehouses are the distribution centers.
That's a good framing. And just like in commercial logistics, the distribution centers are the nodes where the most value is concentrated at any given moment. That's why they're high-value targets despite not being the final storage point.
What about the rockets and missiles themselves? You mentioned short-range systems in the tunnels. Where do the longer-range precision systems live?
That's one of the most closely guarded operational secrets, and the honest answer is, we don't fully know. But the working assumption among analysts is that the longer-range systems, the Fateh-110s, the M600s, the Zelzal-2s, are stored in hardened, dispersed locations, some underground and some in specially reinforced above-ground facilities. They're moved frequently. The launch vehicles are separate from the missiles. The whole system is designed so that no single strike can take out a significant fraction of the capability.
Dispersed, mobile, and modular.
The North Korean playbook, essentially. North Korea has been doing this for decades with their artillery and missile forces along the DMZ. Hardened artillery positions, dispersed logistics, mobile launchers. They've exported that expertise to both Iran and Hezbollah.
Let's go back to the prompt's question about obfuscation. How does it work in practice? What are the specific techniques?
There's a whole toolkit. At the physical level, you've got concealment in civilian infrastructure. Warehouses that look like commercial buildings, factories in industrial zones, rocket launchers in residential courtyards. You've got camouflage and deception. Dummy facilities, decoy movements, false heat signatures to confuse thermal imaging. You've got dispersal. Never concentrating enough assets in one place that a single strike is catastrophic. You've got mobility, moving assets frequently so that intelligence goes stale fast.
At the information level?
Communications discipline is the big one. Hezbollah learned the hard way that electronic emissions get you killed. They use couriers for sensitive communications. They use fiber optic networks that don't radiate. They use encryption when they do use electronic communications. They compartmentalize information so that even senior operatives only know their slice of the operation.
They exploit the civilian noise floor.
That's the most important technique and the most controversial. By embedding military assets in civilian areas, they make every target a potential civilian casualty event. That constrains Israeli targeting in ways that a purely military facility wouldn't. the international law framework around proportionality and distinction becomes a defensive asset for Hezbollah.
Which is a diabolical strategic innovation. If we're being honest about it, they've turned the laws of war into a force multiplier.
They're not the first to do it, but they've refined it to a high art. The legal and moral framework that Western militaries operate under and that Israel is held to by the international community creates an asymmetric vulnerability that Hezbollah exploits systematically.
Let me ask a more tactical question. When a shipment of components arrives at one of these warehouses, what's the actual process? How does it get from the warehouse to the production facility to the field?
Based on what's been pieced together from intelligence reports and captured documents, the process is highly compartmentalized. The shipment arrives, usually by truck, often in a standard commercial container. The receiving team doesn't know where it came from. They verify the shipment against a manifest that uses coded identifiers. The components get sorted and repackaged for distribution. A different team handles the distribution, and they don't know what happens upstream. A third team handles the production, and they don't know the distribution routes. No single team can compromise the entire chain.
It's cellular logistics, basically.
Cellular logistics is exactly the right term, and it's slow. It's inefficient, it introduces errors and delays, but it's survivable. A state military would never accept this level of inefficiency because they don't have to. They can protect their logistics hubs with air defense and perimeter security. Hezbollah can't do either at scale, so they trade efficiency for survivability.
Which raises an interesting question. At what point does the inefficiency become operationally crippling? There has to be a threshold where you're so slow that you can't sustain combat operations.
That threshold depends on the intensity of the conflict. In a low-intensity conflict, sporadic rocket fire, occasional cross-border raids, the cellular model works fine. You can stockpile slowly. You can move at a deliberate pace. You can maintain operational security. In a high-intensity conflict, something like the 2006 war, or a full-scale ground invasion, the model strains and sometimes breaks. You need to move ammunition forward faster than the cellular model can support, which forces you to take risks, which creates vulnerabilities.
That's exactly what we saw in 2006. Hezbollah's logistics held up well enough for a 34-day conflict, but they were drawing down stockpiles faster than they could replenish. By the end, they were running low on certain munitions.
They learned from that. The buildup since 2006 has been explicitly designed to sustain a longer, more intense conflict. The shift to indigenous production is part of that. If you can manufacture locally, you're not dependent on resupply convoys from Iran that might get interdicted. You've got a production base that can theoretically keep running even under bombardment as long as the facilities survive.
Has that theory been tested?
Partially in the 2024 escalation. The IDF struck multiple production facilities in Lebanon and Syria. Hezbollah's rocket fire continued at significant volume for months. That suggests either they had substantial stockpiles, or they had enough surviving production capacity to keep feeding the fight, or both. The IDF assessment was that they degraded, but didn't eliminate Hezbollah's production capability.
The distributed model works, at least to a point.
It works well enough that it's become the template for other Iranian-backed groups. The Houthis in Yemen have adopted a similar model, adapted to their terrain. Iraqi militia groups have elements of it. It's become the standard Iranian playbook for building resilient proxy forces.
Which means the intelligence and targeting challenge isn't going away. It's proliferating.
It's getting harder, not easier. As these groups learn and adapt, the signatures get fainter, the windows get shorter, the costs of errors get higher. The warehouse strike today is one data point in a much larger, long-term competition between surveillance and concealment.
Let's zoom out for a moment. If you're a logistics officer in Hezbollah, what's your actual day-to-day? What are you worried about?
You're worried about three things, probably in this order. One, survivability of your assets. Are your warehouses and production facilities still intact? And if not, how do you reconstitute? Two, throughput. Are components moving through the system fast enough to meet operational demand? Three, security. Has your network been compromised, and how would you know?
Those three priorities are constantly in tension. More throughput means more movement, which means more observable activity, which means less security.
That's the fundamental trilemma. You can't optimize all three simultaneously, so you're constantly making trade-offs based on the current threat assessment, the operational tempo, and the available resources. It's sophisticated logistics management, just applied to a domain that most logistics textbooks don't cover.
The logistics of being hunted.
And that's what makes it intellectually interesting, if you can bracket the moral dimension for a moment. These are real operational challenges being solved by real people under extreme constraints. The solutions they've developed are innovative, even if they're in service of objectives we find abhorrent.
The IDF's counter-logistics effort, that's equally sophisticated, right? They're not just bombing warehouses and hoping for the best.
Far from it. The IDF has invested heavily in what they call counter-logistics intelligence, understanding the supply chain well enough to identify the critical nodes where a strike does disproportionate damage. It's not about destroying every rocket. That's impossible. It's about finding the bottlenecks, the precision machining equipment that can't be easily replaced, the specialized chemical precursors that only come from a handful of suppliers, the technical experts whose knowledge is irreplaceable.
The skill set bottleneck is probably the hardest to reconstitute.
You can replace a warehouse in months. You can replace machine tools in weeks if you have the procurement network. Replacing a senior engineer with 15 years of experience in guidance system design, that takes a generation. And that's a target set that's very hard to protect because those people have to move, have to communicate, have to work in facilities that can be located.
The human capital is both the most valuable asset and the most vulnerable.
Which is why Hezbollah invests so heavily in secrecy around its technical personnel. Identities are protected, work locations are compartmentalized, families are often kept in the dark about what their relative actually does. It's a security state within a militia.
Let me ask about the specific warehouse in Beirut today. What makes a warehouse in Daia worth striking now versus 6 months ago or 6 months from now?
Almost certainly time-sensitive intelligence about what was in it at this specific moment. It might have been a shipment that just arrived. It might have been a stockpile that was about to be distributed. It might have been a cache of components for a weapons system that Israel considers a red line, precision guidance kits, for example, which turn unguided rockets into something much more dangerous.
The precision guidance issue is a particular Israeli concern.
It's been the primary concern since at least 2013, when Hezbollah first started receiving precision-guided munitions from Iran. The Israeli strategic calculation is that Hezbollah, with a large arsenal of precision, guided rockets changes the military balance fundamentally. Unguided rockets are a terror weapon. They cause casualties and disruption, but they can't systematically degrade military infrastructure. Precision-guided rockets can hit specific airbases, power plants, ports, command centers. That's a qualitatively different threat.
The warehouse logistics aren't just about storage. They're about a specific weapons capability that Israel considers existential.
That's why the targeting is so aggressive. Israel has made very clear, publicly and repeatedly, that it will not allow Hezbollah to achieve a critical mass of precision-guided munitions. They've drawn a red line, and they've enforced it through a sustained campaign of strikes on production facilities, warehouses, and supply routes. The warehouse in Beirut today is almost certainly connected to that campaign.
The campaign has been going on for years now, with varying intensity.
Since at least 2017, when the IDF first acknowledged striking precision missile facilities in Syria. It's been a low-boil conflict conducted mostly in the shadows. Strikes that aren't always claimed, targets that aren't always publicly identified, a constant background hum of interdiction.
A war in the interstices.
That's a good phrase for it. A war fought in the gaps between official conflicts, in the gray zone where attribution is ambiguous and escalation is managed through careful calibration. The warehouse strike is part of that war, not a new escalation, just the latest move in a very long game.
To pull this back to the core of what the prompt is asking, the factors that drive above ground versus underground storage, the sophistication of the logistics, and the obfuscation game.
The factors are primarily functional. Underground is for tactical mobility and survivability of ready-to-use assets. Above ground is for the logistics nodes that require space, power, accessibility, and the ability to blend into civilian infrastructure. The sophistication is high. These are not ad hoc supply chains. They're carefully designed, professionally managed, and continuously adapted in response to Israeli interdiction. And the obfuscation operates at every level. Physical concealment, communication security, compartmentalization, civilian embedding, and the deliberate exploitation of legal and moral constraints on Israeli targeting.
Compared to a standing military, they're playing a different game entirely. A standing military optimizes for throughput and standardization. Hezbollah optimizes for survivability and deniability. The logistics reflect the strategic circumstances.
The strategic circumstances are fundamentally asymmetric. Hezbollah can't defend its logistics nodes with conventional air defense, so it defends them with concealment and civilian shielding. It can't move supplies in large convoys, so it moves them in small, dispersed shipments. It can't operate openly, so it operates covertly. Every aspect of the logistics is shaped by the vulnerability.
Which makes the intelligence challenge for the IDF a constant race against adaptation. Every technique they develop to detect and target gets studied, analyzed, and countered. The half-life of any given intelligence advantage is measured in months, not years.
That's the dynamic that makes this conflict so persistent. Neither side can achieve a decisive advantage in the logistics war. Israel can degrade Hezbollah's capabilities, but not eliminate them. Hezbollah can reconstitute, but not faster than Israel can interdict. It's a grinding stalemate punctuated by periodic escalations.
A stalemate that's measured in warehouse strikes and tunnel discoveries, and the slow accumulation of marginal advantages.
Which is a grim way to describe it, but accurate.
One last angle. How much of this logistics infrastructure is dual use in the economic sense? Are these warehouses and factories contributing to Lebanon's civilian economy at all? Or are they purely military assets dressed up as civilian ones?
It's a spectrum. Some facilities are purely military. They produce nothing but weapons components. Some are dual use. A factory that produces construction materials might also produce components for hardened bunkers. Some are civilian facilities that are occasionally used for military purposes. A commercial warehouse that handles a weapons shipment once every few months. This ambiguity is deliberate and makes the targeting problem even harder.
It means that striking these facilities has genuine economic consequences for Lebanon, which is already in a catastrophic economic state.
Which is another dimension of the asymmetry. Hezbollah's military infrastructure is embedded in an economy that can't afford to lose productive capacity. Every strike on a dual-use facility has a civilian economic cost. That cost becomes a political constraint on Israeli operations, which Hezbollah factors into its site selection.
The layers never stop.
They really don't. Every decision ripples outward into tactical, operational, strategic, economic, and political dimensions. It's what makes this topic so resistant to simple analysis.
I think we've worked through the major pieces. The warehouse is a logistics node optimized for throughput and concealment through urban blending. The tunnels are tactical infrastructure optimized for survivability. The sophistication is genuine, but shaped entirely by asymmetric constraints. And the obfuscation game is a multi-layered competition that neither side can permanently win.
That's a fair summary. I'd add one thing. The trend line is toward more sophistication, not less. Both sides are learning. Both sides are investing. And the stakes are only getting higher as the weapon systems become more precise and more destructive.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, a pigment chemist in Madagascar developed a vivid yellow paint additive derived from local chromite deposits and briefly notated its molecular structure using a system of triangular symbols he invented himself, a notation that appeared in exactly one published paper before being abandoned entirely.
Right. This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you enjoy the show, leaving a review helps more than you'd think. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. stay curious, keep weird in mind.